It's good to see everyone here. We only have a couple more weeks of this quarter before we shift again to new teachers and new topics, new opportunities. In line with that, as I see Doug coming in, I'm going to be gone this coming Sunday. My family and I are going up to Polish in the Pulpit in Tennessee. I spent a couple of days up there, so I won't be here this coming Sunday, but Doug has agreed to fill in as we're coming to a close of the Book of Kings. And he's going to be looking at Josiah and some of those other people around them. And then our last week, we're going to be looking at the fall of Judah. So only two more sessions after this, and we'll cover a lot of information when it comes to Josiah. Really interesting character that runs parallel with some of the things we're going to see with Hezekiah this morning. So that's kind of where we are in our study and what we're thinking about. Before we dive into the story of Hezekiah, let's spend a little bit of time in prayer, and then we'll deal with the text. Let's pray together. Lord our God, we come before you grateful for this day. Thanks for allowing us to be here to study your words. Whether it's us in this class or any of the other members in other classes, thank you for the opportunity that we have to carry your word with us, not only in our hands in a physical way, but also in our hearts. You have allowed it to be a sword that cuts deep into our lives and our souls so that we can live it out. Help us to learn something today that we can share with others that I may need some encouragement, they may need to know something about you that they don't yet. We love you very much, God, and we pray this to you in the name of Jesus. Amen. So as I said, our task this morning is predominantly going to focus on the story of Hezekiah. We kind of came to an abrupt end last week as we were looking at those quick kings, coming together where they had those little short reigns there in Israel leading up to the exile of Israel, the northern kingdom. And remember that Assyria has come in and they're the ones that have wiped them out. So if you're following along, and I hope you took the challenge to read 2 Kings chapter 17, where you get to see God's heart breaking. And I dare say if you read it and you've been following along and you understand God's struggle, but also the opportunities that he has taken with these people to try and lead them back to where they need to be, it causes our heart to break. And it makes me think, man, how can we be better? How can we be more dedicated to God and be like some of these kings that are in Judah where they are making reforms and doing things on behalf of God where a heart is set on God like David. But there's even those little glimpses that we saw of Israel, these northern kingdoms, the northern kingdom with these northern kings who at times started doing what was right, but they would not go all the way. And it's such a challenge for us in our lives. We need to go all the way with our faith, allow it to change and permeate every aspect of our life. And the key character we're focusing on today is Hezekiah that does some incredible things when it comes to changes in Judah. We're going to learn about his father. We kind of glossed over him, and so we'll backtrack and get some fast facts about Ahaz, and that'll lead us to understanding the story of Hezekiah a little bit more. So if you're following along with these kings, you're looking at the line that we've seen so far, and Nick did tell me that he's working on getting this focused, so you're just going to look at colors and just know that these are the kings up there. But anyways, so we've come through the dynasty of Jehu. He was the one that started making these changes and working on behalf of God, but also allowed a lot of sin to start coming through. He was usurped by Shalom that led to Menahem, that led to Pekah, and then finally Hoshea was the last king of Israel, where we get to 2 Kings chapter 17, where Israel is taking into Assyrian exile. So they're no longer on the scene at all. And that's going to take us over here next to our kings, where we saw Uzziah. And it's interesting, if you're wanting to kind of put the Bible together in chronological order, I would encourage you to do this, specifically when you get to the books of the prophets. Because, you know, we sandwich them in at the end of our Old Testament, it seems like. And we just think that maybe they come in line together. Maybe we don't even have a sure footing of what's going on. I would encourage you, go to these prophets and read just the first couple of verses, and you will find where they fit into the chronology of what we're talking about. Specifically, we're going to be seeing the character of Isaiah. He's not a minor prophet, he's a major prophet. And a major prophet is they just wrote a longer book. That's what makes them major. And so Isaiah, if you read the first few verses, it says during the reign of Uzziah and Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah, Amos, Hosea, these other writers, these other prophets, they're going to do the same thing. So if you're wanting to line them up and you want to get a little bit more of an insight on how God feels with the kings of Judah and a little bit of the kings of Israel, because it'll have some crossover there, read the first few verses and you'll go, that's how it fits into 2 Kings. That's where we are. But a lot of the prophets that we have at the end of our Old Testament, because we've been looking at prophets this entire time. They've been popping up in our stories. But these longer writings with the major or minor prophets, you can fit them into the Kings that we started looking at last week and what we're considering today. And so it's good just to have all that converged together where you get God's perspective, but God's emotion from a lot of different angles. You get his love, you get his justice, you get his anger, you get his patience, you get his compassion, and all these writers are coming out and they're sharing that. And so it's so interesting to line them all up that way. And so as we're coming through here, we are making our way to the very end, which is the end of Kings, but it's also the where Judah is going to be led into exile, and that's going to take us into a whole nother section of the Old Testament in chronology. But we've kind of looked at Uzziah. We're going to hop into the story of Ahaz, that is the father of Hezekiah, and that's going to give us some context for what we're considering today. As we've been following these kings, we've been putting them on a line of understanding how they fall in line with evil, good, and those that are making reforms. And these are just categories, although I've got it on a timeline. We've seen some really good kings. Amaziah, Uzziah, and Jotham are good kings. They're right there in the middle. But we're going to have a little bit of decrease, well, actually a very drastic decrease with Ahaz. I want to spend some time talking about his evil. But then we're going to pop back up to somebody that is making some solid reforms. And then we'll dive down again next week when you think about Manasseh and Ammon leading into Josiah. So just have that in your mind. That's where we are in the story and what we're trying to focus on here. All right, so let's talk about Ahaz. Just a couple of fast facts about him. So Ahaz becomes king after his father Jotham dies. And so if you want to go to 2 Kings chapter, let's see, I've got here chapter 16. And you'll see today when we talk about Hezekiah, we're actually going to spend a lot of time in Chronicles because I like the way that it shares the details of these stories. And you can get a little bit more detail about Ahaz and some of the wicked things that he does by bringing in the book of 2 Chronicles. But just as we're trying to figure out who he is and what he did, you can look here in chapter 16. He veers from the tradition of the past three kings and decides to do what was evil. Look at 2 Kings chapter 16. We'll start in verse 2. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God, as his father David had done, but walked in the way of the kings of Israel. There's been a couple of times where we have seen kings of Judah be so wicked that they are described like a king of Israel. Sometimes it'll just say that they were evil, or they did not do what was right in God's eyes. It's a whole nother category when it is said, you're like the kings of Israel. Now, Israel is going to be off the map in the next chapter for us, but it's right here at the cusp of them ending. But he is described as one of the kings of Israel. And this is what he did. He even burned his son as an offering, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. That's what's happening here. You've got this king that has gone so far into pagan worship where he is offering his child as a sacrifice. Now, we're going to see Hezekiah that's going to come along, and I think if you look at some of these practices and you look at their views of it, this was the, you know, probably his first son that he offered up this way. This is where you can read Isaiah and Jeremiah and some of these other people that talk about the God of Molech, where people will cause their children to pass through the fire. Essentially, what's going on, a God like this that they would offer their son, it would be a big bronze image, have a head of a bull, and it'd be a bronze image that had a skirt around the bottom of it, and it would sit out with its arms like this, and they would light a fire underneath it until the whole thing became hot and molten. And so they would take their children, and they would put it into the hands of this God and just watch their children burn in its hands. That's how they'd offer sacrifices. Specifically, there was a location outside of Jerusalem where this kind of practice was done. And there's all kinds of different archaeological evidence to tell us what was going on. You can even read different writings where the people would go down to the Valley of Hinnom. We also can take it and swap it over to the Valley of Gehenna. And you can see Jesus playing off of some of that context when he talks about the topic of hell and the weeping and gnashing of teeth. You think about these people going down to the Valley of Hinnom to worship by offering their children as this sacrifice. and watching them burn alive. It was kind of the Valley of Hinnom was this refuse pile where it would just, this is where you'd take all of your trash outside the city and you would burn things out there. This is where they would go. And this is what Ahaz decides to do. It shows how far he veered from his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather before him. In verse 4, it says this about him. And he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. Everywhere that he could find a place to worship another god, that's exactly what he did. You read Chronicles, and it's interesting as you find this path that he goes on to get away from God and what he enacts to go so far away from the proper practices. There's no other word to describe him besides just despicable and wicked. He commits these horrible acts, making these sacrifices on every mountaintop, every area that he can. So he's bringing in more and more offerings. It's during his reign that Pekah, one of the final kings of Israel, the king, he is also working with him. They're fighting each other. And Ahaz asks for help from Syria, and eventually he'll ask help from Assyria as well. So Ahaz petitions Assyria for help, and the way that he does it is he takes some treasures from the temple, offers it. He says, not that big of a deal. He strips down the temple, takes away some of its beauty, its gold, its riches, passes it on as a tribute. It appeases for a little while, but eventually that's not going to last either. And I thought this was interesting. Let's go to 2 Chronicles. I want to read this point about Ahaz. In 2 Chronicles chapter 28, one of the last lines that we have on these fast facts. 2 Chronicles 28, look at verse 16. At that time, King Ahaz sent the king of Assyria for help. So Israel is coming in and fighting against Judah. And actually, this whole reason why it was happening, the reason why Israel was fighting against Judah, was God was using Israel as a tool to humble Judah. But Ahaz goes outside of God and ask for help of this nation that's eventually going to take away his cohort. Verse 17, for the Edomites had again invaded and defeated Judah and carried away captives, and the Philistines had made raids on the cities. Jump down to verse 19, for the Lord humbled Judah because of Ahaz, the king of Israel, for he had made Judah act sinfully and had been very unfaithful to the Lord. Verse 20, so Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came against him and afflicted him instead of strengthening him. So he sent tribute. He was wanting to appease and get Assyria on his side, and Assyria's like, I'm not going to listen to you. So he actually turns around. Instead of being strengthened by them, he is being humbled by them. The plan blows up in his face. Verse 21, for Ahaz took a portion from the house of the Lord and the house of the kings and the princes and gave tribute to the king of Assyria, but it did not help him. His plan failed, because he has no strength. No one is on his side, but specifically God is not on his side. And this is where, it's one of those verses that you would want to underline because it's got a teaching for us. Verse 22, in the time of his distress, he became yet more faithless to the Lord. This same king, Ahaz. If we're honest with ourselves where we are more susceptible to sin, it's in our distress, isn't it? The further that we slide down where we don't know which way to go, it's in those moments where we start making worse and worse decisions. In his distress, when he had nowhere to turn, which he could have turned to God, and God would have pulled him up out of the mire. He would have helped him at every single way, but he didn't. And it was in his distress that he completely turns away from God, where he starts petitioning other gods. And if you read the last of that chapter, verses 23 through 27, that's exactly what he does. He turns his back on God and starts introducing these other gods, hoping that they would give him help, that they would give him aid, and nothing happens. He dismantles the temple, takes away everything, starts erecting temples inside the temple, altars inside the altar, where you walk into the temple mount and you can't even tell who the god is that belongs there. Remember, there was the singular focus in Jerusalem that this is where God's name can be found. But now, during his reign, if you were to walk in, you know what you find? Multiple names of multiple gods. Nothing to the one true God. That's how far Ahaz has plummeted. That's how far Judah as a nation has plummeted. And that's what takes us into the story of Hezekiah. I do have this Fast Facts card about him, but we're actually just going to go through his story in its entirety. But just so you can come back and reference this, I'll pop it up just for a second. But looking at his reign, it's between 715 to 686, and still in line with the Davidic dynasty. His father is Ahaz. We're mostly going to be looking at 2 Kings 18 through 22, but a lot of this is going to be coming from Chronicles, where it expands a certain portion of his story. So just know that's the Fast Facts, but let's get into a little bit more detail about Hezekiah. All right. So Hezekiah, he is one of our reformers. If we put him on our charts, he's one that brings about revivals and reforms. I like the word reform. Here's some things that we know about him. He becomes king after his father dies, just of a natural death. And Ahaz has left the kingdom in a very, broken and ravaged condition. As we see in, let's go back to 2 Kings. Second Kings chapter 16, starting in verse 1. Let's read these verses about Hezekiah first. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 18, starting in verse 1. In the third year of Hoshea, that's going to be the last king of Israel, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that David, his father, had done. There's that key phrase that we see where he didn't do good like his father, because Ahaz didn't do anything at all. It didn't even jump to his grandfathers, which we could have said, his grandfather, great, and great-grandfather, that they did good. But it jumps all the way back to the beginning. And what is the key for us understanding these reforms? It's a heart wholly dedicated to God. And so that's why he's described as a good king. And here's what he did in verse 4. This is going to be the short synopsis that we're going to expand out further. Verse 4, he removed the high places and broke the pillars and cut down the Asherah. And he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the people of Israel had made offerings to it. Verse 5, he trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. For he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments that the Lord had commanded Moses. And the Lord was with him. Wherever he went out, he prospered. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. He struck down the Philistines as far as Gaza in its territory, from watchtower to fortified city. Now, how much of a difference is that between his father? A man that comes in and just brings in all these different offerings and all these different sacrifices. And that's these references that I have on this second line here. Looking at 2 Kings chapter 16, where we saw the introduction of Ahaz. But then also these verse references. And there's even more that we could add onto there of the things that Ahaz did. Essentially, the kingdom that Hezekiah is inheriting has been completely ravaged by sin. The reason why it's broken, the reason why it's not succeeding, the reason why there are enemies on every turn is that they had allowed sin to be their dominating factor. So Hezekiah, wanting to make reforms, make changes, he starts with the high places. He breaks down the pillars that were part of Baal worship. He cuts down the Asherah, which is the female counterpart of Baal. And I think this is so intriguing. It's popped up in this story, and we haven't really thought about it for some time. They are still holding on to this bronze serpent that Moses had made in the wilderness. Now, if you kind of add up and you find out where we are in history, they've been holding on to this bronze serpent for about 700 years. Now, there's nothing, too crazy about that, because you think about the tabernacle, you think about the Ark of the Covenant. They had been holding on to those since Moses had established them. But if you remember, there's this episode in Numbers chapter 21, verses 4 through 9, where the people are complaining and whining, as they normally do in the wilderness. And God says, okay, well, I can humble you. So he sends snakes, these fiery serpents, into the camp, because when they would bite, they would hurt. And people are dying, they're crying out, they're asking for help. And so God says, all right, Moses, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go make this bronze serpent, put it up on a stick, and then put it in a certain location, and anybody who's been bitten by a snake, if they need to be healed, they need to go and look at that serpent. It's real simple, but God has all these plans for you to be able to trust in him. And in that example of faith, it's not just, you know, and I can hear multiple preachers use that as an illustration. It's not just believing that the serpent is over there. You actually have to go where it is. That's what faith does. It requires you to move. The people had been holding on to that bronze serpent. And I don't know if it had any significance outside of that other than just a reminder of, hey, guys, remember when these snakes came in the camp because we were a bunch of complainers? But somehow things had shifted as we're reading here, where they're just not holding on to it as a symbol of God helping them and giving them aid, but they're offering worship to it. They've turned it into its own God. And so Hezekiah comes in, breaks down all of these different things, but also breaks down this bronze serpent. And the words that's used here are also the same words that's used when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai and breaks into pieces the golden calf. He grinds up, causes people to drink. That's exactly what Hezekiah is doing here. He is going into every nook and cranny of the kingdom and removing every bit of false worship. I thought this was an interesting quote, you know, because we just keep coming back to it. Why the high places? This one individual wrote this. It's hardly a contradiction because they're talking about some of these maybe disagreements. I thought he removed everything, but then they're over here. So it's hardly a contradiction to say that, you know, my dad removed all the weeds from the garden, but that my mom removed all the weeds from the garden a month later. That's the nature of weeds and wooden idols. They spring up incessantly. It should not surprise us that this is the case for high places and altars. They're easy to build and are sown by the festering idolatry in Israel, though at times this idolatry would have been suppressed and less visible. Exactly what goes on. Why are these high places here? Because they're easy to pop up in a certain location. Every time you turn around, another weed has popped up. And Hezekiah comes in, and he's weeding the garden. He's removing every single sight of things that are outside of God's will. And we're going to see this in more detail. We have the short synopsis of what Hezekiah is doing here, but it's really through the book of Chronicles that we get a fuller explanation of what he does. And so we're going to spend some time in Chronicles, if you don't mind, veering outside of Kings. Let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 29. We're going to start in verse 3. There's a few key moments in Hezekiah's life or in these reforms that he does that we should pay attention to. 2 Chronicles chapter 29, starting in verse 3. In the first year of his reign, underline the significance of that. The man is 25 years old when he takes over after his father. We've seen other kings like this where they were even pushing out their mother or their father, whoever it was, so that they can do what is right. In the first year, straight out of the gate, this is what he does. In the first month, no time at all. It's like he was waiting maybe for his father to be out of the picture. When he takes the throne, he opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. Now, we've seen the house of the Lord be in disrepute multiple times. I told you, if you're reading through 1 and 2 Kings, look at every single time a king would come in and remove treasures and possessions out of the temple and offer it up as a tribute to somebody else, or maybe even when it's pillaged. The first time we saw it was Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. He takes the treasures of the temple that his father Solomon had built, and he gets rid of them. Well, it's because Egypt came in and took them away, but there's still some things that go on there. So gone are the days of Solomon's majestic temple. It has been pillaged. It has been removed over and over again. And even people like, Jehoash, that when he becomes king, some of the reforms that he does, he rebuilds the temple. Remember, he brings in the stockpile of funds and he makes it nice. That's even gone over and over again. But what Ahaz did, he went in and he desecrated everything. He even sold the altars. He sold all the utensils and everything. Those are gone. And so Hezekiah, apparently they had just closed the doors and like, look, this is just an empty building. Hezekiah comes in, he opens up the doors. And he says, look, it's time for us to make this right. He repairs the doors themselves. Verse 4, he brought in the priests and the Levites and assembled them in the square on the east and said to them, hear me, Levites. Now consecrate yourselves and consecrate the house of the Lord, the God of your fathers, and carry out the filth from the holy place. For our fathers have been unfaithful and have done what was evil in the sight of the Lord our God. They have forsaken him and have turned away their faces from the habitation of the Lord and turned their backs. Can you think of some psalms or even songs that we sing about coming into God's holy habitation? He said they've turned their back on that. It's not just the physical filth. Yeah, they probably need to sweep it. They need to wipe it down. But the consecrating tells us there's a lot more at stake here. There's a lot more religious things that they need to get right where they haven't been able to draw near to God like they were supposed to. Because what Ahaz brought in was just this terrible place. It almost gives us a glimpse. And I think there's so many crossovers between Hezekiah and what we see with the story of the Gospels with Jesus. Jesus comes into the temple in John 2 or Matthew 21, and he sees the temple being filled with things that are not right. And he's going to cast them out. They're coming in, they're saying, look, we need to get this right. Verse 7, they also shut the doors of the vestibule and put out the lamps. As he's talking about the people before them, they shut the doors of the temple and the vestibule so people couldn't come in and put out the lamps and have not burned incense or offered burnt offerings in the holy place to the God of Israel. It's been a long time since the pleasing aroma of a sacrifice had been smelled in this place. Verse 8, therefore the wrath of the Lord came on Judah and Jerusalem, and he has made them an object of horror, of astonishment, and of hissing, as you see with your own eyes. Referencing Ahaz fighting against Israel and even fighting against Assyria, he said, look, you saw it happen. You witnessed it with your own eyes, and here we stand. Look around you. He's got these priests and the Levites. He said, this is where you're supposed to be working. This is the place that God has put you in charge of. You are a Levite. You are chosen to be here to do these things. And when's the last time you smelled a sacrifice? When's the last time a fire was lit? When's the last time the lamp was lit? He said, we haven't been worshiping. We have not been doing what we're supposed to do. And God sees this, and you all see it. For behold, verse 9, our fathers have fallen by the sword, and our sons and our daughters and our wives are in captivity for this. Part of them were led into captivity. Israel came in and took them captive, but Assyria had also come in and tightened up on them and restricted them a little bit more. Verse 10, now it's in my heart to make a covenant with the Lord, the God of Israel, in order that the fierce anger may turn away from us. My sons, do not now be negligent, for the Lord has chosen you to stand in his presence, to minister to him and to be his ministers and make offerings to him. He reminds the priests, he gives them a charge and he tells them, look, you guys need to be doing what God has asked you to do. The priests and the Levites physically and ceremoniously cleanse the temple and prepare it for its proper function. And it's not just for them to work in. This is the place where God's name can be found, where all people from all areas can come to worship God. If you can't come to the temple to worship, where are you going? Well, Ahaz introduced all these different gods, all these different things. He said, you pick whatever you want, whatever flavor of God, whatever flavor of worship. If you want to offer your son as a sacrifice, you do that. If you want to give all your riches, you do that. If you want to follow after sex, if you want to follow after whatever this is, you go worship a God that fits that. Well, Hezekiah comes in and he says, we're done with all that. There is one place and one name where we will worship. And so he cleanses and he calls them to do it, to make the right decisions. And so you get in verse 12, and it goes through this list of all the different priests and the Levites and who started doing all these things. But I look at verse 15. We're still in 2 Chronicles 29, starting verse 15. They gathered their brothers and consecrated themselves and went in as the king had commanded by the words of the Lord to cleanse the house of the Lord. The priests went into the inner part of the house of the Lord to cleanse it. And they brought out all the uncleanliness that they found in the temple of the Lord into the court of the house of the Lord. And the Levites took it and carried it out into the brook of Kidron. They began to consecrate on the first day of the first month. And on the eighth day of the month, they came to the vestibule of the Lord. Then for 8 days, they consecrated the house of the Lord. And on the sixth day, the first month, they finished. Then they went in to Hezekiah, the king, and said, we have cleansed all the house of the Lord, the altar of burnt offering and all its utensils and the table for the showbread and all the utensils that King Ahaz had discarded in his reign when he was faithless. We have made ready and consecrated, and behold, they are before the altar of the Lord. They said, it's all ready. We've set the table, literally, for things to be done. We've cleansed it. I mean, we've made sure that everything physically is the way it needs to be, but also God had very specific rules about who could go into the Holy of Holies, who could touch the showbread, who was allowed to even enter the certain parameters of the tabernacle, of the temple. And they said, look, we've laid everything in its place. We've stepped back. It's now time. Let's see here. Jump to this slide. So he starts these reforms. He opens the house of the Lord. He gets the priests and the Levites to cleanse the temple. But then he's going to ensure that temple worship is restored in the way that it's supposed to. And you can follow through with these verses, starting in verse 20 and going through the end of the chapter. But essentially, here's what's going on. Hezekiah restores the temple worship by stationing the priests and the Levites in all their specific roles and where they're supposed to be, and tells them, this is what you're supposed to do. This is what God has asked in the law. But then he also shows us these are some things that David instituted. And there's some neat arguments that we can make throughout those verses there. Just a couple little highlights of things that I noticed in here. They're preparing the temple itself so people can worship properly. But in order for them to offer worship to God, they have to have priests in place. This is very important for us to understand Jesus. Jesus is the great high priest. We do not have access to God without him being the high priest and the proper sacrifice. Just because they've got the building ready for people to be able to worship correctly doesn't mean that things are really the way they need to be. It had to take some time for the priests and the Levites to consecrate themselves. Let's kind of look through some verses here. Look at, jump down to verse 34. We're in 2 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 34. But the priests were too few and could not flay all the burnt offerings. So until other priests had consecrated themselves, their brothers, the Levites, helped them until the work was finished. For the Levites were more upright in heart than the priests in consecrating themselves. Now, this is all going to fall underneath the Levites. But there's these certain groups of what a priest was supposed to do and what a Levite, specifically coming from Aaron and down from there, that they were really the ones that were working in one area. The priests were kind of doing the day-to-day duties. If you wanted to offer a sacrifice, a burnt offering, you had to come in. And so flip over to Leviticus starting in chapter 1, and that's where you can see what you're supposed to do. You had your sacrifice. You were supposed to walk into the temple. A priest would come and take your offering. You would put your hands on it, signifying this is my sin that I'm passing on to this animal is actually dying because of me. They would cut the animal's throat. They would have to flay it. They'd have to field dress it, everything in the right way. Now imagine thousands of people at a time, specifically something like the Passover, where every family has a lamb. How many lambs would that be? Hundreds of, especially during the time of Jesus, you would think about this, hundreds of thousands of people and families coming in. It talks about in the Herod's temple when Jesus is around that there were these spikes all around the Temple Mount where a priest would come. I mean, just one after the other, they would take one of these lambs, they'd hang it on the post and they'd have to fix it. Then they're taking it right to the altar to have it burned up. And they're doing that over and over again where the floor of the temple is just covered in blood. If you've ever field dressed an animal or seen that being done, there are people that can do, like a deer in like 10 minutes, maybe less. They're doing that over and over again. And it's interesting is they're trying to get all these priests together. They don't even have enough workers. Not enough people have come over to do what needs to be done. But look at some other verses in chapter 30, 15 through 16. This is talking about the Passover. And they slaughtered the Passover lamb on the 14th day of the month. And the priests and the Levites were ashamed, so they consecrated themselves and brought burnt offerings into the house of the Lord. They took their accustomed post according to the law of Moses, the man of God. The priests threw the blood that they had received from the hand of the Levites. For there were many in the assembly who had not consecrated themselves. You just don't have enough people yet. And they're wanting to worship. They're wanting to do what is right. And they're trying to get it figured out. And so it's interesting as you read these verses to see part of the reforms that Hezekiah has to make, it's not just preparing the building, it's preparing the people. You have the priests and the Levites who are the intercessors, the go-between. But then you also have just the people themselves understanding how valuable this is. And that's part of what Hezekiah is doing. He's not just fixing the physical things. He's fixing the people's hearts. And he's not the one actually doing it. But they're seeing the value of what's happening here. I'd go back to 2 Chronicles 29 and look at verse 36. And Hezekiah and all the people rejoiced because God had provided for the people, for the thing came about suddenly in the first year, in the first month. That's what they're talking about. He comes in so quickly to fix all this. They're excited. They're like, this is what we've been wanting to do. We've been wanting to do this correctly. And I think it's interesting if you compare Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4, the church meeting together in the temple, rejoicing for what God has done for them. They want to do it more and more. And you can also see in 2 Chronicles 31, 4 through 10, the people are just excited. And God is blessing them, and they have literally stockpiles of things. And they're like, what are we going to do with this? And they're like, let's just take care of each other. Let's do more for God in his honor, in his name. That's exactly what happens in Acts 2 and Acts 4 with the church. I think that's the kind of reform that we see when thousands of people come fixing the heart problem. They were cut to their hearts in Acts chapter 2. When the heart is fixed, everything else, the desire to follow God and his commandments, will come through as well. So Hezekiah commands all of Jerusalem to keep the Passover. This is in the next section in 2 Chronicles chapter 30. Remember, we just have the short synopsis in 2 Kings. This is what he's doing. Okay, this is what he's doing in the first year that he is in charge, in the first month. Well, they're supposed to be keeping the Passover. This is something you're supposed to do on a regular basis, but clearly they have not been doing it. So Hezekiah, if you start reading in verse 1, he says, look, I want to celebrate the Passover as one of the first things that God instituted when the people came out of Egypt, that they were supposed to remember that God will pass over their sins and that he will take care of them. They're supposed to keep in the first month, but because of sin, and you can see this happening in Numbers chapter 9, 1 through 14. We talked about this in our class last summer, untying the law, where God said, okay, if you are unclean, then just go ahead and do it in the next month, but make sure you do it correctly. So Hezekiah sends this letter to all the people in all of the surrounding area, and he says, we're going to celebrate the Passover. I want you all to prepare. That means that you need to get your lambs, and you come to this temple. It's so encouraging. My last line that I've got on here, even some people that were left over from Israel, although they were led into exile, of course, the Assyrians couldn't get everybody. They were scattered. There are still some true Israelite people in the area. And Hezekiah sends the letter to them as well. Look at 2 Chronicles chapter 30, verse 10. So the couriers who have these letters went from city to city through the country of Ephraim and Manasseh and as far as Zebulun. But they laughed them to scorn and mocked them. However, some men of Asher, of Manasseh, and of Zebulun humbled themselves and came to Jerusalem. The hand of God was also on Judah to give them one heart to do what the king and the princes commanded by the word of the Lord. You keep reading through this section. The Israelites, who had been worshiping in Dan and Bethel with these false gods, they turn. And God's excited, and the people are excited. Can you think about parables where Jesus tells this story of going into the highways and the byways and to invite everyone? It would have been very easy for Hezekiah and the people of Judah to look at Israel and like, that's exactly what you deserve. No, you can't come to this city. And he said, no, we're going to ask anybody. Anybody that wants to come worship God, you come here and we're going to worship because this is what God has done. And although we have people around us that were taken into exile because of their sin, let's fix the sin. And then we can draw near to God, and he will help us. So encouraging and so humbling to think about this is what God was doing with the people. And Hezekiah just got to be a small part of it, of leading people in the right way, in the right path. Just a few other things to think about with Hezekiah. All right, so we've got these reforms, the religious reforms. People come in, they're able to worship according to God's plans with the Passover, and everything's going well. He organizes the priest and a lot of great encouraging things there. But I want to think about another major component in these last few minutes of our study. Go back to 2 Kings chapter 18. It's interesting that the story of Hezekiah, it has multiple different witnesses to it. Here's what I mean. The story of Assyria coming to talk to Hezekiah, which is this next section, We can read about it in Kings. You can read about it in Chronicles. You can also read it about in Isaiah chapter 37. He retells the same story. You can also read about it in the documents of Assyria. There's this piece of archaeology. It's called Sennacherib's Prism, where it describes in detail Assyria coming to talk to the king Hezekiah and asking for tribute and getting it. If anybody has doubts about things that are going on during this time, just know it has multiple witnesses to it to show us that God is very active and that these are historically accurate. But there's this episode where Assyria, who has already taken, and this is where we are in the story, Assyria has already taken Israel into exile. And they send this group of messengers to Hezekiah, and they say, look, we're coming your way. Yeah, you can try and give us money. You can surrender if you want to and just let us take you away. We'll take you somewhere real nice. We'll give you homes there. Hezekiah, as we saw in the little short synopsis, that he did not serve Assyria. These people come and they even start mocking the God of Israel, the God of Judah. They come in and Hezekiah's already prepared for this. He tells all the people, he said, look, I'm only going to send a few people to stand on the wall. Everybody else stand guard. Don't even open your mouth. I'm going to stay back here. They're going to send this group that's going to come and they're going to try and convince us to surrender. Don't listen to them. Anything they say, we'll take it to God. Do not argue with them. But here's the argument that Assyria offers up of why they should surrender. This is just the few bullet points about it. Jerusalem had no military might or skill to resist. Syrians come in and it's like, look, you don't even have enough people. If I were to give you enough chariots for you to use, you don't even have enough people to sit on them. So it's not by your own strength you're going to succeed. God could not save Jerusalem any more than the gods of the cities that Assyria had already taken. So the Assyrians are going to come in and they say, look, your gods are nothing. If you think you're going to get your strength from your gods, go look at every other nation that we've wiped out. They had gods. They're nothing compared to us. Your God's just one more thing that we'll stomp on. He said, oh, you're trying to depend on Egypt? Really? He said, that's a broken reed. The way he describes it, he said, imagine if you had this broken reed that, you know, so take a reed, break it in half. You have all these shards that are coming up. He said, imagine if you were going to use that as a handle. You're going to use that as a staff. It's going to stab through your hand. He said, you're going to lean on Egypt. We're going to wipe them out too. So you don't even have any military might. You don't even have any mercenaries that you can use. And then they even lie about this. And they said, oh, and plus your God has told us that we're going to do this. I do wonder what the Assyrians learned about the God of Israel as a whole, the God of Israel, but the God of Judah, when they took Egypt out. I mean, when they took Israel out. Hezekiah, here's this argument. He goes in and he prays to God for help. God answers his prayers. He never gives in, and he always trusts God. I think there's a lot that we can learn about Hezekiah that is also going to parallel to what we're going to see with Josiah a little bit later on. But man, so many great things to learn. Go and read this story some more, and I think you'll be blessed because of it. Appreciate you guys being here. That's all that we got.